to address an English audience and tell them about my experiences in America. But such are the circumstances here this evening. Let me say, to begin with, I must ask our older friends to bear with me if I advance some very simple facts this evening. The meeting, as you are aware, is primarily for the benefit of younger people. And looking through one or two items of interest which I have jotted down to help my memory, I may be open to criticism at the close of the meeting that I have been too simple. But I must ask you to bear with me. I thought that as well as speaking of my own particular leading over to America, I thought it would be as well if I gave you just a little talk on the American people, their customs, and life generally over in that vast continent as compared with ours in this little island. So then my talk this evening will be a talk on items of general interest, and then finally a word or two in regard to God's good providence in directing me to that country. I do not want to introduce too much history. I'm sure our young people have learned it all in school. Neither do I wish to introduce too much geography. But just as a background, you are aware that North America is comprised of independent states, known as the United States of America, each state with its own governor and with its own laws. And we speak of our king at Buckingham, our queen at Buckingham Palace, and over in North America, they speak of their president at the White House. My wife and I live in a city called Grand Rapids, in the state of Michigan. Michigan, by the way, is about the size of the British Isles. And Grand Rapids, where we live, is about 800 miles inland from New York. So you will see that when we travel by sea, we have another 800 miles to journey when we arrive at New York. 800 miles takes us on an average about 2 days. Because, as I will mention later, although there are such wonderful roads in America, there is a speed limit of 70 miles an hour. They don't mind you going a few miles over that, but not too many. Grand Rapids is about 150 miles south on the Canadian border and about 250 miles from Niagara Falls, which place we had the pleasure of visiting last summer. For the benefit of our younger people, I mustn't ask them too many questions, but I do not know whether they are aware of the names of the five lakes, the five great North American lakes. Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, Lake Ontario, Lake Erie, and Lake Huron. And we live about Grand Rapids is about 30 miles east of Lake Michigan. And when we speak of lakes over there, well, they are lakes and not ponds. Lake Michigan is several hundred miles from north to south, and about 100 miles wide. In the state of Michigan, there are in fact 11,000 lakes. An important point which has a bearing upon the temperatures in the summer, to which I shall later refer. Needless to say, you are all aware that North America is a vast continent. We think over here of our own little island, some 400, 500, 600 miles from north to south, and about 100 or 150 miles wide. But over there we have the vast continent of the United States of America, stretching over 3,000 miles across. Our younger people will be interested to know that there are still some Red Indian settlements, known now more as Red Indian reservations. I have never been to one, but I would like to go and see some of those Red Indians still living in their original conditions. Of course, they are fast dying out. But I might mention that around the surrounding districts where these settlements are, you can see in the features of the people, well, what I might call the Indian features, the Indian face, very easily recognized in many instances. Our young people will also be interested to know that you can still find some wild animals in North America, and also in Michigan, wolves and bears. I have not seen any so far, but they are there, and they are hunted annually. The American people on the whole are a very friendly people. You will find that whether you shop in the stores or whether traveling about the country or whether traveling in public transport such as the railways and the few buses that there are, there's a friendly atmosphere. Generally speaking, they are most helpful. And I'm sorry to say, I do not find the same spirit over in England. There is, as you are probably aware, a very, very high standard of living. Every family have their cars, not one but two or three. Every home have their fridges. A home without a fridge hardly exists in America, probably because of the high temperatures during the summer months. But no matter where you go, in the homes, or taking their travel, their car, and in so many different directions, the standard of living is very, very high. The amount of food eaten there is tremendous. We sometimes say among ourselves that the American people do not eat to live, they live to eat. And in fact, there is an extreme, doubtless, in that direction. We find the food bill over in Grand Rapids very much higher than our food bill was in England. I have no reliable statistics to bring before you, but broadly speaking, I would say that the cost of living is about 2.5 times that in England. But of course, correspondingly, there are very high wages. There are high costs and there are high wages. You may be interested to know, the gentleman here, if you want a haircut, you'll have to pay from 13 shillings to 17 and sixpence. I can manage to get one for 13 shillings, but that's comparatively cheap. And so it goes on. I'll not take up the time to mention the many instances, but I'll give you one or two in reverse. Petrol in America costs far less than it does in England. It costs about 2 pence a gallon. But the gallon is only 4/5 of the English gallon. Nevertheless, that is one point where we find things a bit cheaper. Fruit, too, is quite cheap, comparatively, although vegetables and meat, etc., are very, very high. It is certainly difficult if you run up a high doctor's bill. You have only, as we say, to look at a doctor and it'll cost you some $5 or $6, about 30 shillings. It's always very risky to call up a doctor on the telephone because there will be a charge go down against your account in the account book. Hospital charge is also very, very high. But of course, correspondingly, the service is very, very wonderful. When you walk into the doctor's surgery or waiting room, it's a very lavishly furnished room, cold in the summer, heated in the winter, every convenience. The doctor has his nurse. He has his laboratory technician. He has his various secretaries, etc. He will have some 5 or 6 rooms all fitted out in the surgery. Well, all those things have to be paid for. But just in passing, I might mention that if you are ill, you've got to go to the doctor. They don't like coming to you. If you're dying, they'll come to you. But otherwise, you'll have to get a friend to take you in his car. No matter what your temperature, you have to go and visit the doctor. They do not like visiting their patients. But that's only by the way. Another point I would like to mention here, generally the food of the American people. They have breakfast. They have a very light lunch midday. And about 6 o'clock in the evening, they'll have what they call supper, which is equivalent to our hot midday meal. And then, perhaps late in the evening, they will have a cup of coffee with some biscuit or a cake or something like that. No heavy late meal as we know it over in this country. The Americans do not like cold meals. My wife and I, we live the English fashion. I'm very fond of cold meat and potatoes. The average American people wouldn't give you a thank you for it. Everything must be hot. If they have a sandwich, they prefer it warm. If they have bread, they prefer it warm. We like cold ham. They will warm it up. And that is the general trend of things. And not only in their own homes, but if you should go out for a picnic, then they'll warm it all up and put it in insulated carriers or boxes or something in order that it will be warm when they come to eat it. Again, let me say, my wife and I live like English people, and I'm certain we always will. Forgive me if I'm bringing forward small points, I think they are of interest. At least you won't read them in history or geography books. Sometimes we invite our friends to dinner, but they will not use a knife and fork as we do. If we give them a cut, we'll say, of roast off of the joint, they'll put it in between their bread and eat it. You can always tell an American over here, in a restaurant, he uses his fork, not a knife and fork, as we do. They're very fond of their barbecue. If you should go out into the public parks, and there are many of them, you frequently see a blue haze hanging round over the whole of the park. It's where they're barbecuing their hamburgers or sausages, weenies as they call them. The cold meal as we know them, they do not like them. The majority of families will have their barbecue on their back lawns. And then a good many will carry a portable barbecue equipment in their car. They must have their meals hot or go without. Our young people are probably aware of the military system in America. The children at school over there, they don't have heart sons of LSD. It's all intense. The American dollar is at the moment worth about 7 a penny English money. For the benefit of our younger people, over in America we have pennies. They're very small, about like the old English farthing. And 14 of those pennies are equivalent to 1 shilling English money. Then, as we go up the scale, we have what they call the nickel. That's a five cent piece, a cent or a penny. They call a penny sometimes a cent and sometimes a penny. A nickel is 5 cents. A dime is 10 cents. The next coin is a quarter, that's 25 cents, that's a quarter of a dollar. The next coin is 50 cents, that's half a dollar. And then you have what they call the dollar bill, not the dollar note. And the dollar bills, they go up in ones, there are a few twos, but generally it's 1, 5, 20, 50, and 100. So, young people, you can see how that the sums in the American school, as far as money is concerned, are very, very simple. As far as weight is concerned, we were very surprised to find that the 100 weight, as known in England, is not known over there. They speak of 100 pounds. 112 pounds is just nothing, it's foreign to them. Before we went over 4 years ago, in exchanging in our letters between the deacon of the court where I'm pastor and myself, we exchanged photographs and we told each other about each other. And as a result of the exercise I had experienced in regard to going over, I lost about a stone and a half in weight. And I wrote and told the deacon over there that fact. I said, I've lost a stone and a half, and nobody knew what I meant. And so they had to go to their American dictionaries, and they could not find it. The only definition an American dictionary will give of the word stone is the stones we pick up on the ground. But someone found an English Webster, and then they thought that a stone in England also meant 14 pounds. So that was one very amusing incident when their future pastor wrote and told them something they didn't understand at all. As far as the language is concerned, of course, it's the English language. I sometimes tried our American friends. They pride themselves, justly enough, on their independence. But I tell them that they have to be dependent upon the poor old English for their language. Of course, they try to improve upon our form of spelling. In some directions, I admit, there is an improvement. But in other directions, no. When our friend the chairman mentioned the fact that he used the word fortnight, I also used the word fortnight in a letter. I haven't the faintest idea what a fortnight means. That word does not exist in the American dictionary. We don't say fortnight, we've got to say 2 weeks. They just do not know that word. Another interesting point I might mention in regard to words, and of course, as far as pronunciation is concerned, I'll not go into the details. Quite a number of words they address quite different from what we do. It doesn't matter where I go, they always know I'm English. I believe I shall forever remain so. But I think we, on one occasion, we wrote and told one of my daughters that a certain family were very homely people. And my daughter, in her reply, not in a letter, but on a little 3-inch tape, which we frequently pass backwards and forwards to each other, she said, "I'm pleased to hear that that family is a very homely family." Well, we played that tape back to a number of our American friends, including their family. And when we came to the place where my daughter said, "We are pleased to hear they're a homely family," there were roars of laughter. Homely in America means ugly. But you know, I'm wondering, this is a point which I have not followed out, but I followed it up in the dictionaries, and you know there is the old English meaning of the word homely is ugly or deformed. And I had a real shock one Sunday. I gave out my own hymn, and I gave out, we used Gadsby's hymn book, and I gave out hymn number 710. "When you get home, look at it," in verse 5. I'll read it through. This is Barry. I know he was quaint, but he was a scholar. He was the hymn is on the deceitfulness of the heart, the wickedness of the heart. And he said, "Sweet love and sweet shame now hallow his breast, yet black is his name, though by his Lord blessed. I am," he said, "homely, deformed in each part, all blessed, and yet comely, through Jesus' desert." There, in the original meaning of that word, Bennett simply tells us that he's a homely or ugly creature defiled by sin. Well, that's just a little point in passing. Over here, the children are very fond of sweets. In America, they're candy. Over here, we like our cookies, our biscuits. In America, they are called cookies. Now, there's a very high degree of mechanization in all aspects of life, in engineering and in building. I have been particularly interested seeing the numerous roads that are being built. In America, you see huge machines at work and very, very few men. But they get the work done. Generally speaking, I would say that handmade goods or handicraft in America are of a poor quality. They are not so much taught the skill with their hands, but rather the skill in using the machinery to make it for them. I've also been very struck by the tremendous amount of imports from Japan. Cameras and refrigerators and all the things made in Japan. There is also a high standard of standardization in homes. over here, no matter what you want, you have to make sure that it fits. But in the homes over there, I know this will be of interest to our chairman and the quantity surveyor, there's a very high standard of standardization. If you want a lock in any door in your house, you'll get one just to fit the mortise. All the sash fasteners, everything, the electric fittings are all the same. It may be a different make, but the standardization there is really remarkable. And it doesn't matter what goes wrong, it doesn't matter what you want, you go down to the hardware store and you get it and fix it. Although the people, as I say, are very industrious, the American people will always find out an easy way to do a job. You know, the American people are very fond of doing jobs in their cars. They're very reluctant when they won't get in their car, they seem to want to stop there. If they go to the bank, they do not get out of their car. They have all driving banks. There's no need to get out unless you particularly want to. I believe driving banks are coming in fashion in this country. If you're out and you want a telephone, you don't get out of your car. You drive to the petrol station, and there is generally the telephone, and you just put your hand out of the car window and use it. If you feel disposed to have a meal at a restaurant, you need not get out of your car. You drive to the appropriate telephone at the side of the restaurant. You take the receiver, get your order, and then bring it out to you in the car. If worldly people want their cinema show, they go to a drive-in cinema. If religious people want a church service, they go to a drive-in church service. Huge screens, about 30 foot square, both for the church service and also for the cinema show. So you'll see that the American man doesn't like getting out of his car. But of course, there's hardly any public, well, not hardly any, that's rather an exaggeration, but there's very, very little public transport. As you journey over North America, you will see tens of thousands of acres of land, all running wild. And this is the point where one feels disposed to be highly critical of the North American administration. I have spoken of a high standard of living. When over here, particularly during the war, we all knew what it was to try to keep things down. Now over there, they have to do all they can to keep things up. And the American government will pay the farmers the equivalent of 5,000 acres to let it run wild. Friends, I believe that's all wrong when the biggest half of the world is starving. But that is a fact. And the purpose is to keep up the high prices. I am told that among the very, very big farmers on the prairies, equivalent to Canada, over in Midwest and West America, the farms there, they comprise some tens of thousands of acres. It seems dreadful when you think that a government pays the equivalent of 5 pounds an acre to let the land run to ruin. But such are the conditions prevailing over there. And so the majority of small farmers, they put their land into what they call the soil bank. They draw their $14 an acre, that's what it is, equivalent to £5, and then if they feel disposed, they go and work for somebody else, a little light job to keep them going. Also, all over America, you will see tens of thousands of elm trees, all dead or dying. I liken the position there to that of myxomatosis among the rabbits in England some years ago. It is a disease which has spread everywhere in the United States of America. And the general opinion is that within a few years, you will be unable to find an elm tree in the whole of that continent. It's really a terrible sight to see all these trees, so many of them already dead, and many others dying. The houses, at least in Grand Rapids, and generally in modern cities, are of timber. Well made, well insulated, although I noticed that many modern houses, they are having an outer skin of brick. And for those of you interested in building, the brick in North America is not 9 by 4.5 by 3, it's 6 by about 3.5 by 2. In our home, we do not shut ourselves into the dining room or into the drawing room as you do here. Everything is open. In the winter, we have storm windows, which we just slip in with a clip. When summer comes or when spring comes, we take them out and we put in screens. We never open a window and leave it open like you do here, because of, chiefly, the mosquitoes. All homes are centrally heated, generally with hot air, automatic. We just set the thermostat to whatever we want. When we were first shown over our home, we thought it would be around about 62 or 64, or in the south like we were. But we go into other people's houses, and 75 is quite common in the middle of winter. 75 in our own church, or chapel, we call them church over there, so we have to follow suit. So you will see that during the winter months, we do live in comparative luxury. We have a front lawn and a back lawn to our house, but they call them yards. We think of a yard as being some little concrete area at the back of a terrace house. But no matter how beautiful your lawn, and no matter how beautifully your back garden is laid out, that's your back yard in North America. The temperatures in summer in Grand Rapids are very high. We heard from our friends only this last week, and they tell us that the temperatures have hovered between 95 and 105. Well, it wouldn't be too bad if it were not so humid. But because of the many thousands of lakes which exist in Michigan, it's very, very humid. And I must say, my wife and I find it very, very trying. Very difficult to know what to do in the summer. So the shops are cool. Many people have a cooling conditioner system in their car. Some of the well-to-do churches have it in their churches. But even if you sit indoors in that luxury, you still have to go out into the air, and it's very, very hot. It's too hot to work in a garden, or too hot to work in your home. The best thing to do, to have work to do, is to get up and do it early in the morning, and then lay about for the rest of the day. Of course, we wear appropriate clothing. We wear truly tropical clothes over there. The suit I have on at the moment is what I call a mid-season suit. My mid-summer suit is very much thinner than this one. Although this one I have on is something like the alpaca wear over here. Now, in the winter, of course, it's very, very cold. We get it down probably to 10 degrees below zero. But it's very dry. And even though you have to be careful of your extremities, your ears and nose, etc., when you go out, you do not feel it as much as you do in England, because it's so damp. But the standard, what I might call the standard of measurement of temperature over here is generally freezing point. You will talk about so many degrees of frost. You never hear that expression in America. You never hear any reference to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It is always zero. Of course, further inland, temperatures go down much lower still. But we live in comfort. You may have to, we have to go outside during the winter months. No troubling really every morning. 2 years ago, we had 92 inches of snow. Now that's a good sign. But it is not the wet snow which you are so used to in England. It's very, very dry. Nevertheless, it has to be cleared, and it's nothing afresh for one to have to go outside in the morning and shovel your way out when the temperature is 0 degrees, and then you come indoors and it's 75. Well, that's quite a big change. And it wanted a lot of getting used to. In the winter, of course, we also wear outdoor workers. They wear appropriate clothing. Insulated shoes, insulated underwear, insulated gloves, and sometimes electrically warm clothes. You would be amused, I'm sure, to see some people come into our church in the winter and take off their earmuffs and hang them on the chest or put them in their pocket. Earmuffs are frequently worn. I might mention here too that full advantage is taken by the state authorities to provide good, healthy pastime or sport, if you like, for the children. In every park there is a pond. All through the winter, of course, that pond is covered with ice. There may be a fall of snow. The snow clouds overnight will sweep off all the snow. Then they'll bring out the hoses and put a new layer of ice on the top, all ready for the children to go skating the next day. I like to see it because it is a very healthy and good recreation for young people, and it keeps them away from workplaces. Then there are the official toboggan and ski runs. They do certainly look after the children there all through the winter, and also with their numerous swimming pools during the summer. As far as schooling is concerned, it is much about the same as in England. Although I would say that, as far as I may judge, at least in Grand Rapids, the standard is very much lower. However, evidently the American people must make up for it somewhere or other when they get older, perhaps, because they are well away in advancement of engineering and other sciences. There are quite a number of what are called Christian schools, like the Church of England schools here. The Reformed churches have their own schools. The Roman Catholics have theirs. Some other Methodists and Baptists they may have theirs. This is more prevalent over there than in England. There is an interesting point about school buses, and that is if you are travelling by car and a school bus stops either to pick up or to put down any children, there are some possibly 15 to 20 lights all around that bus, and those lights are blinking, and all traffic has to stop. No matter which way you're going, if a school bus is stopping for alighting or picking up, then all other traffic has to stop. Otherwise, you're in for a heavy fine. I think it's a good idea. And the driver of the bus, he makes sure that everything is clear before he shuts off the danger light and continues. So just a word or two with regard to roads, transport and layout. Roads generally over there run from north to south and east to west. If you take an average map, it is all divided into squares. There will be found roads radiating from the cities, as in England, but they are all the modern freeways or interstate freeways. But otherwise, the roads are all set out from north to south and east to west. Grand Rapids provides us with a typical layout of a North American city. Imagine a square, all the roads running from north to south, they're called streets. All the roads running from east to west are called avenues. So imagine this square, which would be the perimeter of the city. Then cut the square into four, with a horizontal and a vertical line. Those center lines are four division lines. And then one section would be northwest, northeast, southeast, and southwest. And all the roads and avenues in the whole of those squares are cut up into far smaller squares, what in North America they call a block. 10 blocks to a mile. So if you go wrong, you just turn around, you go around the block and come back. You can't lose your way. And I was very interested when there I wanted to perhaps ask some of my friends the way to go. They wouldn't tell you to go down the street and turn to the left. They would say, now go down to the street, then turn west. Go a little further, then turn north. It all points to the compass. It's quite remarkable, even the children, and all people too, they know the points of the compass. Right and left, as we know it, is not used as a term of direction for traveling. Many of the cars are equipped with a compass, and I find it very, very useful, because if anyone tells you to turn to the north, well, you know where to turn. Otherwise, if there's no sun shining and you do not know the city, you may be in some difficulty what to do. Taking this square of the city, the top line would be the north belt line, the bottom line would be the south belt line, then one would be west and the other would be east. the freeways, as we call them, the great trunk roads in America, well, they're very wonderful. Makes travelling very, very easy. Since I've been over here, I have been on several of the N trunk roads over here, and they're much about the same, except that they are generally on a vaster scale in North America. When we speak about freeways, I mean a road of limited access. In America, you have to pay on quite a number of them. Automatic payment. You come to the red light and there's a hop ahead and you have to throw in 30 cents. It doesn't matter what coins you use, providing you make it up to 30 cents, then the light will go green. If you only put in 29, it will not. But I put in a quarter and 5 cents. I deliberately practiced just to see how things work. But providing I put in the equivalent of 30 cents, then I'm all right. Of course, there are, I think I mentioned, very, very few buses. It's all cars in America, or taxis in New York, and the big cities like Chicago and Detroit. Children are taught to drive at high school when they are 15 years old. A year's driving teaching is in the official curriculum. And I must say that when they're 16 years old and they take their driving license, there are some very remarkable drivers. I was really very amused to see a mere girl of 16 years old sitting behind a huge Packard or Cadillac and driving off about 70 miles an hour. I will not say that there is not a danger there. There is. You take a young lad, 16, 17 or 18 years old, with an 8-cylinder engine in front of him. He's tempted to do just what I was when I had the same experience. I've got a tremendous speed. But generally speaking, the standard of driving, both young and old, and I do see many old people, I don't know how old they are, but they still drive. Having driven, I suppose, the majority of their lives. Driving licenses over there are the same as ours, but it's a good idea that they take them out on your birthday so that you don't forget when they called you. The car tax is much cheaper than in England. I have, compared with English standards, quite a heavy car. It's only a compact, but it's quite a large car by English standards, and that cost me between $9 and $10. That's about £3.06 for my year's license. Well, I don't buy a license. We purchase our number plates and we keep them. If we change the car, we keep the number plates and put it on the new car. And periodically, they are changed. If you're traveling over anywhere in America, you have no worries about food or petrol or sleeping. Friends, I found the difference over here. For traveling about in America, take for instance the restaurants. You can go, you can find restaurants everywhere. You don't see signs, restaurant or cafe, you'll see a large sign, eat. They're always talking about eat, with an arrow directing you to the place. And the food provided there, very wonderful. You go in and sit down, and the first thing is done, summer and winter, a glass of ice water. Always put before you, whether you want it or not. We have had two or three quite interesting experiences. in restaurants. Over in England, I know you often find on the menu some names in some such in the French language which you can't fully understand. But over there, the average dish is so different from what we're used to in England. When we went to Niagara last year, we had a boiled egg for breakfast. Well, they bring it rolling about on the plate. You never see an egg cup anywhere. And we noticed among our own friends that when they have an egg, they generally just smash it and let it run all over the plate and dip it up with a spoon and bread. And we have just in one or two places among our own friends seen a poor lone egg cup. But generally speaking, they do not use them. On another instance, it's rather humorous, but I think I'll mention it. When we were having a breakfast, we did manage to get fried bacon and fried egg, fried bacon of a sort. And the waitress asked us, how do you like your eggs done? Do you like them turned over, or do you like them sunny side up? Turned over, of course, is turned over in the fat and fried both sides. And sunny side up, as they call it, is just how we Englishers usually have our eggs cooked. Quite an interesting point, and there are quite a number of interesting and somewhat humorous anecdotes I could mention in that direction. But I see our time going rather quickly, and I haven't yet come to the important point. No matter where you go, you'll always find the petrol stations open day and night. Although the American cars, they do not run on petrol, you know they run on gas. That's the equivalent word for petrol. As far as sleeping accommodation is concerned, the whole of the country is covered with motels. And the motels are very lavishly equipped, luxuriously equipped. They have their own telephones, their TVs, and everything you want. But it'll probably cost you £3 or £4 a night for a bed, apart from any food. But in traveling in America, it is quite a point to consider. It doesn't matter where you go, as far as petrol, food, and sleeping is concerned, you have no worries at all. Traffic signs over there are somewhat different. They'll pass that by. Traffic lights are frequently suspended in the middle of the road. And I find it a considerable benefit. And when I come back to England, I have to be very careful lest I should miss those which are on the side of the road. At night, we always drive with headlamps. It is against the law to drive with side lights. Side lights exist only for parking, and yet ironically enough, you park on the side of the road and you don't need side lights. So I suppose it is just if you should want them, if you should happen to be in a place where they would be required. Level crossings over there have no gates to warn you. There are no gates, only flashing red lights. Needless to say, there are many, many terrible accidents. You see the red light flashing, and the next moment the train is sweeping across the road. Winter conditions traveling, of course, are a little difficult, but the snow plows, they work all through the night. And it doesn't matter where you have to go. Unless it's a very, very heavy blizzard, you can always get there. Thousands, yes, must be millions of tons of salt is sprinkled on the road to melt the ice and kill the car.
the car bodies over there, they just get eaten to pieces with the acid in the salt. They also sprinkle a salt, I do not know whether it is exactly the same, over many of the roads which are not what they call, they don't have a hard top, or they're not tarmac as we call it. It's very, very interesting to see how that the spreading of that particular salt over a dusty road is the equivalent of a storm of rain. There are very, very few cyclists over there. You may see just one or two young people, but you never see the flocks of cyclists like you do when Westinghouse is coming out for lunch or at the close of the day. Only just a few, just one or two motorbikes. And there are no rules for cyclists. They can travel where they like. Motorists just have to beware and mind they don't do any damage. Nevertheless, you have to be registered if you have a bicycle, in the same way as if you have a motorbike or a car. All cyclists have to be registered. The police force is somewhat different over there compared with ours. There is state police, there's the sheriff patrol, and there are the city police. Over here, the police walk about with their truncheons very discreetly hidden. In the majority of the cities in North America, they walk about with their revolvers at the ready. All police, other than merely traffic police, they carry revolvers. And it's necessary. The freedom as we know it over here does not exist in North America. The race problem is very bad. Even though Grand Rapids is such a very religious city, going through one particular section of it, you will be well advised to lock your doors and close your windows. Now the general religious profession, I'm rather late coming to it. There's a lot of religion in North America, and there's a lot where I live in Grand Rapids. New churches are springing up every day. The Methodists, for instance, they have a target, one church per week throughout the year. And I am told that they keep to that target. Now that's a lot. Churches are multiplying everywhere, and they're full up. Nearly everybody goes to church. The Sunday observance over there, truly remarkable in comparison with England. Everybody goes to church. The roads get blocked up with cars, they're all going to church. Although on that point I must say that the last 2 years I've seen a great difference. We now occasionally we see the lawnmower come out to mow the grass and so on. And others will go off for their Sunday sport. When we arrived there, generally speaking, the shop or the store were closed. But now we see the sign, open on Sundays or closed on Sundays. We see it gradually coming in, and I'm sorry to say, that a lot of it is due not only to the general spirit of infidelity, but the Roman Catholic Church, go to Mass and do what you like for the rest of the day. We've been over there 4 years, friends. I have not heard one swear word in 4 years. Now that's remarkable. When we landed at London Airport, I'd been there just 10 minutes and I heard swearing. I haven't heard it in America. It's quite outstanding. We were very interested. Just before we left, we had some painters in to do out a couple of our rooms. And they sing hymns. Or talk of more discuss points of theology, sometimes ask me as a minister to come and settle a certain point. You can argue the 5 points of Calvinism with your barber. You can go to the shop and take, if you like, the most unlikely character. That person goes to church, and he or she knows your Bible. We've been really amazed at the general profession. But alas, I must say that it is but a profession when it comes to the possession of grace, marks of divine life in the soul. Alas, we see so little. If you go in a restaurant in Grand Rapids, I know it is a particularly religious city. The majority of the people are of Dutch descent and very religious, as you are probably aware the Dutch people generally are. But you go in a restaurant, and it is nothing to see people bow their head in prayer, and as we say grace before they partake of the food. You may see a family or two families come in and sit round the large table, and one of the men will be disputed to stand at the table and speak a word in prayer publicly before they partake of the food. You need never be ashamed in Grand Rapids of standing before others in prayer. I find things vastly different in hospitals, no matter where I go. Nurses or doctors or anyone will always make provision for the either reading or praying as the minister desires. Some of you may be aware that when I baptized an invalid, once completely helpless, suffering from multiple sclerosis, and she had a number of very bad bed sores, the Lord constrained her to be baptized in accordance with our mode and method of baptism. I shall never forget seeing the nurse, the head nurse at the hospital, where she is. She said, "Well, now we would like to provide you with a trained nurse, if you haven't one, to dress the wounds. We would like to cooperate with you in every possible way." And I thought, well, how different from how things are in England. I've had the unique experience of walking into a hospital and hearing my own voice. As I walk into the ward, the particular patient whom I visit has a tape recorder, and she's listening to my sermon, which I preached on the previous Sunday, in a public hospital. Well, after all, people have their radio. Why shouldn't God's people have their pleasures? They do in North America, but I'm afraid things are somewhat different in England. When we go out into the parks for a picnic, and on the public holidays over there, generally speaking, our own church or a number of them and members perhaps, anything from 20 to 30 of us, we'll go out into the park and we'll have a meal or picnic, if you like, and then we speak on the things of God. One and another will give their testimony, and then we sing a number of hymns. Singing hymns in a public park, nobody takes much notice. Or we may get one or two people come and join us and ask who we are. But the general open religious outlook and the religious profession is vastly different over there from what it is in England. In one restaurant which we have patronized in Grand Rapids, just to show how they mechanize even religion, you will find at the side of the menu suggested form of prayer. And there's a prayer typed out for Protestants, a prayer typed out for Roman Catholics, and another one for Jews. So we just showed you, see, how the general profession over there, as much as we like to see people honoring God, honoring His Word, and honoring His Day, the general profession, alas, is just like one big machine. And in so many directions, it is as dead as a machine. Of course, there are exceptions, to which I shall come in a moment. Of course, the USA is also the home of many evil cults. The Jehovah's Witnesses emanate from the USA. So do the Mormons. So do the Christian Scientists. So do the Seventh-day Adventists. And also there are two other bodies of people. You may have read about it in history book, the Amish people and the Mennonites. The Amish people, they are descendants, as they say, of the old Puritans. And they live their own strict life. They're mostly farmers. They will not send their children to the state schools. They're always coming in conflict with the law. They will not have electricity on their farms. They will not move from the old-fashioned way of living. And there have been cases where the government have found rich deposits of minerals on their land, and they will take the land. The Amish people will not accept the payment. They clear off out of the way. They want nothing to do, as they say, with the world. Of course, we can't agree with them. But nevertheless, they have quite a number of large settlements together with those people known as the Mennonites, and they originate from Holland, and they have many settlements in North America. And just a word in regard to the procedure with funerals in the United States, quite different from England. The corpse is immediately taken from the home, or generally from the home, and taken to a funeral home. Embalming is compulsory by law. My wife and I had a shock when we went to visit the first friend who died, not in my own congregation, but in one of the Reformed churches. We walked into the funeral home, and there was a coffin with the man who had died, dressed in his best clothes, looking absolutely lifelike, even with his spectacles on. Everything just, well, you can't call it death, but that is a general procedure. And I had one funeral only. And the funeral service in the funeral hall is much like a somewhat condensed preaching service. And as I'm standing on the little platform with the lectern in front of me, the corpse is open to view at my side. And if you would wish to pay your respects to a certain individual who had died, then you would find in the paper that the funeral hall would be open for 2 hours in the afternoon and perhaps 2 or 3 at night. The relatives would be there to receive you. You shake hands with the relative, you say, my sympathy, you view the body, and you go back home. You've done your duty. Then the mourners, after the funeral service, the corpse is taken, or in a coffin, which is closed, and it is put in the hearse, very elaborate affair, great big motor cars, or motor-driven hearses. And the undertaker and the minister drives in the front. There's a flashing blue light on the top, similar to what the priest cars have here. And all the mourners, if not driven in the official cars, they will return to their own cars, which have been conveniently parked in the vast parking spaces always available in America. And there you will just have a little ticket hanging on your steering wheel. Please switch on your headlights. On the roof of the car will be a little flag with a suction, rubber suction disc fixing it onto the top of your car. You switch on your headlights, you follow the leader, and the whole procession goes straight to the cemetery, straight over the red traffic lights. Everybody stops and gives place to the cortege. I think it's admirable from that angle. And it's nothing to see. A mile-long cortege, all cars with their headlights switched on, going to the cemetery. Then arriving at the cemetery, chiefly perhaps because of the excessive snow in the winter, but I think it might well be followed in England because of the excessive rain, there is always some sort of a covering. On the sides where the prevailing wind is, and the covering over the top, and it shields you from the bitterly cold winds and also from the rain. The body is not lowered into the grave whilst the minister is there. That's done afterward. And again, by law, there is already in the ground a concrete base, concrete sides. When the coffin has been lowered, then there's a concrete top. The earth is filled in and turfed over, and we get no unevenness in the surface of the cemeteries. One small headstone only is allowed, and the cemeteries are kept beautifully. Now to go to the other side, just a word or two about weddings. I've only had one. I married a couple in their home, 8 o'clock at night. I don't know quite how it originates, but not all will have a church service. Among my own people, in the congregation, among the young people, I have perhaps one who calls himself or herself a strict Baptist, and he or she will not go into one of the other churches on principle. And they're very sticky, you know, on principle, over in Grand Rapids, and correspondingly the other partner won't come to my church. So they get married at home. It's a kind of a compromise. We don't need any registrar. They go through the official registration, of course, beforehand, but the wedding ceremony is frequently at their home. Now, just one or two small points. In Grand Rapids, the majority of people are of Dutch descent, and the city abounds in Dutch Reformed churches, which I may divide into three. Just plain Reformed churches. They went modern, as we say, and the Christian Reformed churches, they came out from them, and they at one time were quite firm upholders of the truth, but now both the Christian Reformed and the ordinary Reformed generally have really fallen back into the world. Then thirdly, there are what we call the Netherlands Reformed churches, and in those churches you will find quite a number of God's people. Mine is a lot of profession. In my own church, we're only a very small group. As far as I am aware, we are the only strict Baptist called in the whole of the United States. I believe among some of the Southern Baptists, there is some form of rule or order in connection or for admittance to the Lord's table, but to be what we call a strict and particular Baptist church, as we understand it in England, as far as I'm aware, my own church is the only one in the whole of the United States of America. Being known as a strict Baptist church, the Reformed people, they're always very interested, very intrigued to know what strict means. And of course, as our young people are aware, strict and particular, as we term ourselves, we are believers in strict communion and particular redemption. But it's very, very difficult for me or anyone else to try to put over these things to the generality of the Reformed churches. Quite a number of sermons by our ministers are read in the Netherlands Reformed churches. They're very fond of J.C. Philpott. And in fact, I have put several of the churches, not only in Grand Rapids, but in Paterson, New Jersey, I have put them in touch with several sources in England where they can obtain sermons, because there are only just one or two ministers who minister in those churches. And I feel rather sorry for those ministers, because they had to learn English. They all came from Holland. But there are two or three of them who speak very good English. The transition among the Dutch Reformed churches from the Dutch language to the English language was very, very interesting. My eldest deacon tells me that about 50 years ago, when they first began to read the Bible in English, there was a terrible storm. They thought everything had gone wrong. And the old Dutch people, they just could not understand a Bible in English. But of course, now we have, among those churches, there are the younger people who are English, and the majority of the churches, the majority of the sermons now preached are preached in the English language. In those churches, it's nothing to get anything from 1,000 to 1,500 people. They're packed out. My own church is a very small group. I have about 135 to 140 people. Quite a good congregation in comparison with English standards. But nevertheless, very, very small in comparison with the standards in Grand Rapids. We use Gadsby's hymnal, the same form of service as we hold over here. Our morning service begins at 9:30. I don't know why it's so early, but that's the time it always has been. Maybe to avoid the midday temperature, the evening service is 7:00 on Sundays and 8:00 during the week. We have our two services on Sundays. Sunday school and Bible class followed our morning preaching service. I take the Bible class personally, so I am in church Sunday morning from 9:30 to 12:00. And during the week we have our preaching service on Tuesday evening and our prayer meeting on Thursday evening. All the preaching services are tape recorded. Friends, I've got to be frank, I've seen God's blessing on it. None of my members who are sick are deprived from hearing the sermon. We take them either to their homes or to the hospital. And I have been very, very touched when I have seen how that a sermon of mine being played over a tape recorder to some sick person who is utterly unable to attend the house of God, God has used it for the good of that person's soul. I haven't time to go into the details concerning myself, but just a brief word in conclusion. As you're all aware, the Lord Himself gave me a remarkable word of direction to go over to that city. I did not ask any questions when I went. The Lord said, virtually, go. And whenever the Lord speaks a word of exhortation, He'll always give you grace to walk in obedience with it. The Lord said, go, and I went. I did not know much about the people. I did not know what I was going to. I gave up my home. I did not know what home I was going to be provided with until the last moment. I did not ask any questions. Friends, you never need ask questions when God gives you a word of direction. Whatsoever He saith unto you, do it. I shall never forget our journey over. The majority of you have read the account which I have printed, covering the various details. We shall never forget walking into our home. They purchased a home for us. They could not raise money at the bank because their group was so small in comparison with the hundreds of members in the churches around them. They could only boast of 7 or 8 to begin with, because my people are those whose eyes were opened, as they tell me, to see the unscripturalness of infant sprinkling, which is the basis of the Reformed Church. Their eyes were opened, and God brought them out, and that was the beginning of the church where I am now. And seeing that the membership was so small, the banks were unwilling to advance any money for them to buy me my home. So they mortgaged their own home to purchase me mine. Friends, that's charity. Perhaps I might mention also that many people, both in my own church and around among the Reformed churches, they give their tithes to the house of God. They give their tenth. They are willing givers. I am a witness to it. And as we walk into our homes, so I must say we have a luxurious home. They asked me whether we would go and stay with some friends whilst we furnished it, or whether they would furnish it before we arrived. I told them to furnish it befitting 2 poor pilgrims, and they did so. Everything is complete. As we walk, we just walk into it, complete from top to bottom, even the kitchen utensils, even the fridge stocked up with food. All we had to do was to walk in and live. But it was a remarkable experience. It was a venture of my wife and I, away from all we had so near and dear to us over here, we ventured into the unknown. But God had given me that call. And dear friends, I cannot say much. If ever the time should come when, like Paul and Barnabas, we may be spared to give an account of all that the Lord has wrought by us, I may be able to speak more freely then than I can now. When we see the unfolding of God's purposes, you know, we're rather apt to misinterpret those purposes. But I see God's blessing upon my ministry. Friends, in true humility, God has given me children. They've been brought out of nature's darkness into the knowledge of the truth. I do not like making comparisons, but I must say this. I have seen over there such a remarkable unfolding of God's purposes, and I have seen through attending the ministry a point which I mourned so much over when I was in England. Do not misunderstand me. Any minister found in his right place will find God's blessing. He can ask God's blessing. The Lord never sends a man but what He sends him for a purpose. And if God sends a man to a people, then you bless that man's ministry to that people. My church has just about doubled since I've been there. There's a gradual building up. My first 2 years were 2 years of sowing. The third year I had quite a bit of weeding. And the fourth year I've seen some wonderful fruit. Oh, there's nothing which can be more supporting other than God's blessing in our own soul. To my wife and I over there, and naturally speaking, you know, our old heartstrings, they get torn pretty much at times. But there is a support when you see God blessing your own ministry. When you can see why He has sent us there. We left a loving family when we came over 2 years ago, and also 7 weeks ago. It is their own wish that we should come. They realize the sacrifice we have made, and so they make provision for us to come. But when we come, then they count the days until we return. What a job it is when you have a big pool both sides of the Atlantic. All are tied by nature over here, but many very strong spiritual ties over there. It's wonderful to go 4,000 miles and find those whom we love in the truth. We can only say, blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above. Many prayers over here are made to me over there. And as hardly a prayer meeting goes by in my church over there, but what ministers and churches, individuals, my own family, whose cares they follow very closely, prayer is made for them all. Well, now what the future holds, I do not know. But just in conclusion, as we pass, I would just say this, friend, I would commend you to God and to the word of His grace, which is able to build you up and give you an inheritance among all them that are sanctified. Perhaps I need not make excuses, but I am a little sorry that I crowded out the first part of my talk this evening when I might have passed things over and dwelt somewhat more fully on the more solid spiritual matters. But remember,